discuss goodwill, amortization by other means. I have been told.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Oh my goodness, it's going to be in trouble with Tina.
It's much more sophisticated than that.
More complicated.
Yeah, it is more complicated.
The details.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Hans. I appreciate the opportunity to explain something about what we're describing as the goodwill accretion approach. This is one of the ideas in a discussion paper which EFRAG published towards the end of June and is open to comment until the end of December. Of course, we would very much welcome any feedback. I should emphasise that this idea is no more than that, along with all the other ideas in our discussion paper. We want to expose this for comment to generate some debates. These do not reflect recommendations or final positions of the EFRAG board by any means. I need to say that with various EFRAG board members in the room, of course, but an important point. We have a short slide deck, paper 5. If we just go to the background slide on page 3. So we have, like many of the organisations in this room, been looking at the question of subsequent accounting for goodwill for a number of years now. Our initial focus was on the merits or otherwise of reintroducing amortisation. It's not at all evident there's any particular consensus in Europe on whether that will be a good or a bad thing to do, so our focus, for the time being at least, has shifted towards looking at whether the impairment test in IS 36 could be improved. And the ideas in the discussion paper are, I think most of them are focused actually on asking other ways we can simplify the impairment test, hopefully without sacrificing relevance, but a simplification focus. This idea might not fall into the simplification category.
You didn't think about
nobody would disagree there.
But if we move on to the objective slide on page 4, I think later on in the ISB staff paper we'll be talking about the pre-acquisition headroom suggestion. That's an idea to try and mitigate what we call the first shield in the amortisation test of goodwill, so that purchase goodwill might be protected from impairment due to the effects of goodwill that exists in the CGUs before the allocation. Certainly the basis for conclusions to IS 36 also talks about the shielding effect of subsequent goodwill, internally generated goodwill, but broadly speaking concludes that because you can't measure internally generated goodwill separately, the objective of the impairment test should be to test the recoverable amount of the goodwill as it exists without trying to separately assess the implications of any subsequent goodwill generation. So, in very broad terms, what we wanted to do at EFRAG is just test that hypothesis a little bit. Is there nothing that we can do about internally generated goodwill? Now, if you're in the kind of school of thought that says, well, internally generated goodwill isn't even an issue, the objective really conceptually should be to test the recoverable amount of the goodwill as it currently exists, you're probably not going to be too interested in the rest of the journey, but nonetheless I'll take you briefly to it. We are working on the proposition that this is a shield, and if there is a feasible way of mitigating the effects of that shield, that's worth exploring. So because we're addressing a different shield, to carry on with that terminology, we don't think this is in any way in competition with the pre-acquisition headroom approach. It could even be complementary, and how these two ideas might fit together, I think, is something.
What is the difference in the two shields?
So the pre-acquisition headroom approach is designed to mitigate the effect of goodwill that exists in the CGU before the acquisition, and this is designed to mitigate the effects of goodwill that might be generated subsequent.
Internally generated
goodwill. Absolutely. So moving on to slide 6, the underlying concept, I think I've gone through the first part of that. So the premise is that to not be impaired, this goodwill needs to be replenished at a rate at least equal to the expected return on the net investment. And in developing these ideas, as far as we have tried to avoid any undue or unnecessary complexity. So applying the mechanics of the approach, we don't think requires any additional inputs beyond carrying out an impairment test under the IAS 36 methodology. We've tried to keep it as simple as we think we reasonably can. And we think this approach will be simple enough to apply, even if there are reallocations of goodwill, if there are internal reorganisations or part disposals. We have those ideas in our minds in moving it forward. So moving on to slide 8, just getting into the mechanics of the approach. We have our purchase goodwill. For the purpose of the impairment test, only not for recognition purposes, we would then accrete or inflate the amount of purchase goodwill by a rate. The question of what rate is something I'll come on to discuss just briefly. So we're not recognising this goodwill accretion. It's a mechanism to try and address the shielding effect of internally generated goodwill. And it's, of course, a proxy for internally generated goodwill. It's not intended to be a direct measurement at all. Moving on to slide 9, then if no impairment loss is recognised, then no immediate accounting consequences, but for the purpose of the accretion approach...
You already completely lost me, but so what is the mechanics of the accretion? What kind of... what's the math?
Okay, well, that's on slide 10.
Slide 10.
Moving on to that imminently. So, sticking on slide 9 for a moment, if no impairment loss is recognised, we just carry on accreting until the next testing date. If an impairment loss is recognised, then of course we reduce the carrying amount of the recognised goodwill, the purchase goodwill. We also reduce this notional accretion by the same amount. Now, I could question whether that's the most appropriate approach, but that's more into the detailed mechanics. And the accretion approach would carry on being applied until, if this happens, the purchase goodwill is fully written off. So moving on to the mechanics, there's a simple illustrative example on slide 10. So in year one, the first impairment testing date, the purchase goodwill is 100. Let's assume the rate is 6%, so we accrete an amount of 6. That means that for the impairment test, we adjust the notional carrying amount from 250, the amount booked, to 256. The recoverable amount's 258, so there's no impairment. In year two, we add a further amount of accretion, in this case 7. That means that the total carrying amount of the CGU for the impairment test becomes 243. Recoverable amount is 238. We have an impairment of 5. And moving on to year three, so of course we reduce the carrying amount of the goodwill by the 5, we also reduce the accretion by the 5. That so happens that there's no further impairment in year 3. So that's the basic mechanics of the approach. I'll just pause if there are any questions at this point, or is that sufficiently clear?
How do you determine the rate in this case?
An open question, Patrick. Yeah, I think that the simplest approach was simply to be used to use the same discount rate that is used in the value in use calculation, and that might avoid any sort of accounting mismatch by accreting at one rate and then discounting back at another.
But you change it every year.
So as you might do with the rate you use for the value in use test, because it's a current rate reflecting the expected return on, or reflecting the risks of the assets in the CGU at a point in time.
Doing so, you oblige companies to do always the value in use test. They might just do the fair value less cost to sell.
Well, another one of the suggestions or areas for exploration, actually both in the FRAG discussion paper and I think in the ISB staff proposals, is whether we actually do need to have these two legs of the recoverable amount test, whether you could revert to one or the other. Just briefly on that point, our paper suggests that perhaps it could just be a value in use based test. It's just an open question. But if it were to be, the value in use calculation would need to be changed somewhat. recent change in the guidance, for example, the prohibition on taking account of future restructuring that would need to be looked at again. That's a fair question.
Yes, can I have a question about the underlying concept of this model? So the underlying concept of this model is written on page 4, slide 4. Which says purchased goodwill being replaced by new unrecognized goodwill.
Mm.
So basically, the purchased goodwill in itself is keep diminishing because it is replaced by the new unrecognized goodwill. Is this the idea, the underlying basic concept of this model?
I think it is, and I recognize not everyone perhaps accepts that.
So then the second question is page 9, which says the entity continues to determine the accretion until the goodwill is fully written off. That means acquired goodwill would, in the end, disappear. Is this the kind of concept you have? Or could be, it depends.
We didn't set out with the objective of getting rid of the goodwill on the balance sheet. Clearly, if one accepts or believes that goodwill is shielded by both pre-acquisition goodwill and internally generated goodwill, if you sort of take away the shields, an impairment is more likely, but certainly mathematically, and we actually think in real life it is entirely possible that the goodwill would still be there for a long time if goodwill is generated. It's at a rate that exceeds the proxy rate we're using in this model.
Okay, then can I ask another question about the mechanics of this model? Can I ask about the table on page 10? So this table is very interesting. So in the first year, you have accreted 6. So you added up 6.
Mm.
And then made an impairment test, but fortunately recoverable amount of CGU was 258. So therefore, you do not recognize any impairment.
Mm-hmm.
However, what if a recoverable amount was same as carrying value of CGU? Say, for example, if you acquired goodwill and you are trying to measure the value of goodwill, but because you couldn't measure it. So if you assume that goodwill stay on the carrying amount,
mm-hmm.
so in that case, you are going to recognize impairment of 6 because you accreted 6. And then in the end, the amount would be 260, if the recoverable amount is 258, so you would recognize the impairment of 6, which is the same amount of accretion.
Yes.
All right. So, okay.
Probably that's coincidence.
Yeah.
In your example, it's probably coincidence that impairment is same as the accretion.
Yeah. But if you have an assumption that you cannot measure the recoverable amount, and if you assume that acquired goodwill's recoverable amount stays as the carrying amount, then eventually this model would require the impairment every year with the same amount of accretion amount. The other mechanism. Thank you.
But then goodwill for second year will reduce by 6.
Yeah, of course. But
it's not exactly going to be like an offset of the accretion.
Mm.
So there'll be some.
Some differences.
Yeah.
But as a mechanism, as you accrete the goodwill, and if the recoverable amount stays same, so eventually you recognize the same amount of accretion.
Ross?
When I read this, I found it to be an interesting idea, but I had one detailed question.
Mm-hmm.
In year 2 on page 10, the 7% rate is accreted. Is it accreted technically off the $100 book value of goodwill or the 106?
Mm-hmm.
It's accreted off the book value.
So 10 years out, because what I understand your theory is that in order to not have an impairment, there has to be a growth in fair value related to the growth associated with the activity.
Yes.
Why don't you compound that? You would think if that was your theory, you would compound that. Because once you get over the first 2 years, you're not. It's less likely to have the impairment theory.
That's a very good question, and we'll take that internally, so to speak.
Well, just a point for reflection here, because in Brazil there is a interesting situation, which is the Central Bank of Brazil has not adopted IFRS fully, and one of the differences is that they require amortization of goodwill. But banks have to release IFRS statements at the same time. So we have a good experience. So we have both published at the same generally at the same time. So, and I did not a very scientific outreach here, talking to a few investors about what set of numbers do you actually use? Mm-hmm. And they say, well, we take out goodwill and completely disconsider it, the amortization of goodwill. And one of the guys from a big American investor say, well, that's noise. That's nonsense. And I asked him, how would you see if there was amortized over a 10-year period? And he just said, well, that's noise. Mm-hmm. Take it out. I never considered that. So the point of reflection here is if we are really adding informative number to the financial statements, or adopting this approach or other approach related to amortization, we are just adding a nuisance to the that everybody going to disconsider this and so no one said that he actually or he or she actually uses that information. Say that I work now with recurring.
So that was amortization type information as opposed to impairment type information, which I think is what.
But they end up having the same effect, which is adding some sort of depletion, of goodwill into the P&L. And I'm not sure if that information is relevant, really. For a user's perspective, I believe we need more evidence on that.
So in the U.S., especially in banking, the banking regulators do not allow goodwill to be considered a regulatory asset. And so whether it's impaired or amortized, they view it as noise because they didn't view the original asset as valid. In other industries, they view the impairment as a lagging qualitative indicator of something that went wrong in the past. But predominantly financial institutions, they don't view the original asset valid, so getting rid of it's not valid.
Yeah, so it's important to consider the investor's view in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And not the first time I've heard that kind of feedback. It's very interesting. And as far as I'm aware of the academic literature, and others are more aware than I am, there is evidence that impairment-based information is highly relevant. So that's one reason why our focus has been seeing whether we can improve the impairment test.
But my personal view of this mechanism is that you achieve accelerated impairment, because every year you add at a certain point the goodwill has to disappear, so you are accelerating the impairment, and maybe not just 1 year but after a year.
Yeah, you're right.
So sort of amortization, if you like.
But I think more complicated, more amortization.
I don't think it's necessarily accelerating impairment, because let's say if the growth assumption when you made the acquisition was certain number, but then if the economy keeps improving and you have better growth rates moving forward, you wouldn't necessarily have an impairment of the goodwill, because the growth assumption initially was probably less than the growth rates that you're seeing now.
But
if the growth rates keep coming down, then genuinely there has to be the impairment of that goodwill which initially assumed a higher growth.
The growth rate must be at least equal as the discount rate you're using, at least.
The accretion rate.
But that's only for the accreted internal goodwill. Your existing acquired goodwill will remain the same at the original assumed growth rate.
Yeah.
And one question to Alessandro. You know, when you say the impairment is ignored, I think what we've heard as part of the
outreach is amortization.
Sorry, amortization of goodwill. When they say it is ignored, I think what we've heard is it is added back to arrive at the projected cash flows. But let's say if an analyst was looking at a company which is a serial acquirer, wouldn't the goodwill to revenue ratio make some sense for projecting the future cash flows?
So, sorry, it's not the point, because financial institutions, they do not project cash flows.
But I agree with financial
institutions.
They do
institutions, not reach cash
flows. But if you're looking at other industries, and let's say if an analyst is looking at a company which is a serial acquirer, so for them to project the performance in the future, I think if they assume that the company would still do those acquisitions, I think the past data of goodwill to revenue probably gives them some information about how much revenue should they project on account of acquisitions.
I mean, this is the person that I've talked to. They do not add because of, in order to achieve expected cash flows. They said that, sorry, this information is too arbitrary for me to consider it, so it's completely noise.
Do they amortize goodwill based on different rates, or is fixed by the central bank, 10 years or whatever, or everybody can do?
Scientifically established at something between 5 and 10, but everybody uses 10.
Very good.
That's consistent. Between 5 and 10, you can choose between 5 and 10, but everybody uses 10. For some reason.
For obvious reason.
Yeah, of course. It's very scientific.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, I must say, I found this quite interesting, and while I perhaps wasn't sure about the concept of the purchase goodwill must be replenished, I think I was more perhaps buying into the alternative notion of saying that at the date of acquisition, is that, in your example, the goodwill of 100 effectively, you know, again, I know we're not valuing it directly, but is it effectively the present value of those benefits at that point in time? That's what the 100 reflects. And are we saying, well, as time passes, if your recoverable amount, and let's maybe take up the rest of the CGU for now, if your recoverable amount stays at 100, that recoverable amount is meant to be the present value of future cash flows, which must mean that, well, you're not taking into account the fact that your initial 100 was determined by present value in the future cash flows, and therefore there needs to be that return. Otherwise, if there isn't that return on that initial 100, then there is some impairment. So I think maybe that's why I could perhaps see some logic in saying that each year that amount, you know, would need to be increased. Mm-hmm. And if your initial assessment holds true, that initially you expected, you know, this return of 6% or whatever, then in theory your recoverable amount at the end of the first year would be 106, and then there wouldn't be an impairment. So I guess is that sort of the theory behind this, to say that, you know, if what actually happens is in line with what you initially thought, then there wouldn't be an impairment.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, if the growth rates are lower or whatever, then there should be an impairment. Without that accretion at the moment, there is a risk that there actually should be an impairment, but there isn't one because we're not taking that into account. So as I say, maybe I can see some logic in doing this if one sees it that way. And I certainly think the positive or the plus is that you are likely to see payments earlier than they otherwise would be, which should address the concerns around the impairments coming too late.
Yeah, thanks. I took it very well what I call our alternative theory, rather than it being a proxy for the internally generated goodwill, because some argue that it's rather an arbitrary proxy for internally generated goodwill. On the other hand, you could argue equally that IAS 36 in effect assumes that goodwill is generated internally at a rate of zero, also is a different sort of arbitrary. But I think what you've articulated is the idea that we often hear from investors what they really crave is information that helps them assess whether the investment, the acquisition, has been successful or not. I don't think you can conclude it's successful just because goodwill you purchased 10 years ago doesn't mechanically happen to be impaired when it might have been protected, replenished by all kinds of things you've done subsequently.
But I don't agree that goodwill is sort of represent the present value of the benefit, because it's calculated as a residual. It's not separately evaluated. It's calculated as a residual. You add up, you step up all the assets and liabilities, the difference with the price of a transaction. This is called goodwill, because we have no other terminology. But it's not a real goodwill. It's not the present value of the future benefits.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It's calculated as a residual, sure. But some would argue that nonetheless it represents real economic benefits.
Represent an asset.
Well, there was
the company must be expecting to earn it back.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. This is why my personal view, go to amortization. I should amortize based on the payback period they've estimated at the date of the acquisition.
Yeah.
Over the period, in what relationship? So if it's a 7-year period.
Ten years.
No, then it would be totally illogical because then the most successful acquisition gets
amortized quicker.
In a very short period. That doesn't make any sense. That's what I thought too in the beginning. It's not logical. You have a solution.
Actually, I would like to share. I just want to share some comments from some Chinese constituents. Actually, we shared this approach to some of the Chinese constituents. Actually, they are the accounting experts in China, but their first reaction is that this approach is too complicated for them. They have some concerns. First one is similar to others, that how to determine the rate, the discount rate. Because it seems that it needs more and more judgment on this, and they think the subjectivity is a big problem. That's the first comment. The second one is that compared with other long-term assets impairment, we always use the book value to be the basis for impairment calculating. Calculation, but under this approach, we use the book value plus the accretion to be the basis for the impairment. The accretion seems to be the expected return on this asset. So they are questioning the underlying concept of this method, because it's different from other long-term assets impairment. That's the second one. The third one, let's look at the table on slide 10. Just now, Russell mentioned that when you are calculating the accretion, you use a fixed amount of the amount of the goodwill, the book value of goodwill, that's 100. Another question is, at the first row, the carrying value of the CGU, it seems like that it seems that the size of the CGU doesn't change year to year. If the CGU itself, the size of the CGU change. Maybe how to measure the impact of the shrinkage of the original CGU. Mm-hmm. There are
they have a lot of concerns. So they support it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I must say, I understand now where this is going, and I can put a good deal on this, as you can for our Hattemoel approach.
Mm-hmm.
If we would, in combination, present this to the prepared community, it would go absolutely ballistic.
Well, it's good to get a reaction sometimes.
Yeah. But it's conceptually sound. Carla.
So Andrew, feedback from our targeted outreach was also that the model is very complex. You know, some of the assumptions behind the equation and the interest rates didn't make sense to them. But I guess the question is, you know, you've used the shielding as a way of justifying that the internally generated goodwill is shielding the purchase goodwill, and that's why they're doing this. So how is that different from an internally generated goodwill shielding a CGU that doesn't have purchase goodwill? And would you say that you would use the same approach because the shielding happens anyway, whether you have purchased goodwill or not? And the other thing is, if you are concerned about the fact that, oh, for the other assets they are depreciated or amortized and goodwill isn't, we also have other intangibles with indefinite life that are not amortized, like rents. And so what would your approach be in those circumstances?
Those are very good questions. I don't think we've turned our attention to the question of other indefinite-lived intangibles. It's a fair point. But one of my responses, you got in there first and said, well, most other assets are actually depreciated or amortized. So it's a different sort of starting point. And most other assets, well, IS 36 says that where you can test an individual asset for impairment, that's what you do. So an asset is only tested at CGU level if actually it doesn't generate independent cash flows independently of other assets, whereas goodwill is, if I call it an asset, is the one asset you always have to test in as part of a CGU. So I think it's a very, very fair challenge, which we'll look at, but if you like, the magnitude of the underlying concern is somewhat different. Goodwill compared to other assets.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that users find very little value from impairments today. The main piece of information conveys is a psychological piece of information that management have owned up to previous overpayments, and so there's sort of a cleansing that we can all move forward now. And I think the judgment here, I mean, it's an interesting approach in terms of the accretion. But will this bring impairment sufficiently forward enough to still beat the market reaching its conclusion? And if it doesn't, then we're paying a price of perhaps unnecessary complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So this may bring it forward perhaps a year or two, but generally the market gets there quite quickly. Not always right, but generally it does get there. Generally it is right on these things.
Mm-hmm.
There are mixed views on targeting internally generated goodwill for the purpose of impairment testing of the purchased goodwill. Some member agreed that the improvement in the subsequent accounting for goodwill should target internally generated goodwill. However, other people thought that instead of targeting internally generated goodwill, rather the introduction of the additional disclosure about recoverable amount, that is the future cash flow estimation for impairment testing, would be a better possible solution of the too little, too late issue. Actually, we think the internally generated goodwill is one of the most important missing data in the financial reporting, which is referred to as the main reason of deterioration of usefulness of financial information. So associating the proxy amount of internally generated goodwill as proposed in the model, in the paper, would not help usefulness of information. We are concerned about the proposed goodwill accretion approach. It could result in a distorted picture of the real economic substance because the approach used an overly simplified assumption. And it is questionable whether it is appropriate to reduce recoverable amount by accretion because the shortfalls in the expected return will have been reflected already in the recoverable amount. In addition to, I'm curious about one thing of the logic of this model. In the slide 8, it says that the accretion is then added to the carrying amount of the CGU. I wonder if this method could be a double counting problem. Because, you know, for example, the purchased goodwill have produced, generated the outcomes as expected when purchased. Then, even in that case, if you added the accretion to the book value of the CGU, the acquired CGU, then it could be a double counting. So I don't understand why we should add the accretion to the book value of the including the acquired goodwill and the other CGU assets. So I wonder what the logic is, maybe convincing or not.
We're just adding it to the carrying amount for the purpose of the impairment test. We're not recognising the accretion in the balance sheet, so it's a sort of memo. It's a memorandum calculation.
Yeah, but it's actually deemed as a nature of new generated asset. Yeah. So if it is so, yes, it could be, but. It's an increase of the acquired purchase, mm-hmm. Purchased the goodwill, then it is not actually logical because it could arise double counting matter.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. This model is very, very interesting. In addition to the pre-acquisition method, shield one, and you are suggesting shield two, second shield. So these are both shields will make our impairment test improves a lot, theoretically. But in practice, I guess the model seems to me not complex at all. It's very simple, based on your calculation of the example. The issue might be maybe faithful representation of approximate of this newly implemented. The measurement issue rather than relevance issue. Another thing there, maybe, so I think you know you need to provide our stakeholders with some kind of explanation on that issue, then this model can be more accepted by our stakeholders. The one minor thing on this model is you said when there is an impairment loss, then the balance of the accretion is correspondingly reduced, mm-hmm. right? So based on the example of the slide 10, if you see year 3, at the accretion you say you deduct 5 from 13. That's another uncomfortableness to me. You know, why you deduct five the total amount of 5 impairment loss to the newly internally generated goodwill? Mm-hmm. So So that's my question. If you do this, you know, in year three, you don't recognize any additional impairment loss. However, if you do not deduct this five this here, then you just count the 13 of accretion, and the other additional year three accretion again, then it will be an impairment. So what I'm saying, the deduction of this five of the previous balance of accretion must have some kind of justification. Why? So there is no, you know, even though I looked at the full report, there's no good explanation. So maybe if you add that kind of explanation to this model, the model will be getting better and better. So this is very early stage, but the people are not familiar to this idea. However, if you, you know, add some kind of justification on your proposal in the model, then it will be quite acceptable. I guess the theory is okay.
That's very helpful. I think the mechanics of the adjustment you make to the accretion on an impairment are something we need to look at in more detail. Maybe a pro rata type allocation would be preferable, but the same category as looking at the discount rate again, and should it be a compounded effect rather than a discrete year by year effect. But I don't actually think it's mechanically complex, really. Thrown out there, it's not actually complex to do.
I think the main problem, which is also the problem of our headroom approach, is that it will be experienced as a very artificial exercise, even though the underlying economics is understandable. But I think preparers already feel that they are living in an artificial world with goodwill and all these exercises every year. And then to try to make that more realistic by building on other layers of assumptions, I think it will just be very hard to accept. Linda.
So thank you, Hans. So I agree with Chen Wu that the approach is interesting. But what I had a flashback to the days when I had to explain to the senior management of a very complex organization why some goodwill and an acquisition they made in the U.S. ultimately got assigned to a CGU that resided in Canada because they changed segments, and why that goodwill would never go away. And I just could see the CEO who said to me very simply that just doesn't make sense to me, Linda. And I can see the very same person saying, looking at this and me trying to explain this, saying, this just doesn't make sense to me. So while it may for us not be complex, intuitively, it just doesn't make sense. And so I agree that it would be very hard to sell. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do things that we think are conceptually sound and we don't do them to sell them. But inherent in what we're doing, I thought what we were trying to do by addressing this was reduce complexity. And I'm not sure, but what we're, even though you say that the math isn't complex, the whole notion of artificially accreting something to then ultimately impair it, but you're not actually, it's a notional amount. Like, I just can't even envision somebody having to explain that, not only to the internal management, but to users. So I would think that collectively we'd hopefully try to find something that was more intuitively robust.
I saved Martin for last because he would like to give some constructive and skeptical comments.
I agree with Linda, because it is a kind of a proxy approach, very difficult to explain to somebody. And I think really if we would follow this approach and also the headroom approach, I think we can end up in, then we have each and any year maybe a little portion of the impairment, and I think that is not very different than from the beginning amortization, and we'll end in the same thing. And what we have, I think then we have achieved something which is very, very complex and costly to do, but have, I think, some each and any year a little portion of impairment, which I think is not very different from amortization, and therefore I think it's successful. And even what Linda said, to explain this approach, man, this, what is accretion of a goodwill? I really don't know what that is. And usually when we accrete something, we see the accretion amount in the P&L,
So we're increasing a carrying value, but in a double entry, we should see that. And we don't see that. We're only doing that for the impairment test, but then if it is covered, then we're doing the impairment and it is going to the P&L. But the accretion first is not going to the P&L. So I don't think this whole concept is not in line with what we're usually doing. Because if we increase in carrying value, I agree with that, but then we're doing the increase in carrying value goes through P&L. But we're doing it only here for some artificial calculations.
Well, summarize that as mixed views.
I thought Noble was going to come in now. Finally, we've got some conclusion.
Oh, no, we thought about these models, we discussed it together with the PH approach. So if we can talk about it together now, then I'll say it now. But otherwise, I was waiting. So.
Okay. Let's go to Raghava.
I'm even wondering, should I TF the PH approach at all?
Same comment.
Well, you know, they took all the flex, so yeah, you can just withdraw with honor.
Looks good.
So agenda paper 5B, the first few pages provide just a brief background about the research project, what we are doing, and also summarize some of the past discussions that we had with you on the Goodwill and Impairment Research Project. Now, from page 12 to 19, we've set out our current thoughts on the pre-acquisition headroom approach. So page 14 sets out how the approach works, and from page 15 to 18, we've illustrated how, all these pages assume that it's a frozen PH. So we're not still finalized our thoughts on whether it has to be a frozen PH or it's a continuously updated PH, because there's an interaction with the simplifications that we are looking at the same time. So these are just our current thoughts. We are improving upon these thoughts, and we'll be happy to take your comments and consider those in our work.
Okay. Thank you.
We considered both the Goodwill and Vision approach and the PH approach together. We thought both ideas were very interesting. We never thought about them. For the Goodwill accretion approach, we fully support the premise that purchased goodwill is replaced by internally generated goodwill, and we continue to believe that internally generated goodwill should not be recognized as an asset. So we kind of like the direction of what the goodwill accretion approach is trying to do. But at the same time, the accretion approach seems to be recognizing this loss as an opportunity loss, which generally is not recognized under normal accounting. And therefore, I think it's difficult to understand and difficult to sell to people who are used to what we've been done in accounting. As for the PH approach, I think the difficulty is essentially to calculate the internally generated goodwill for the CGU prior to acquisition, which I think is well accepted that there's a lot of difficulty in calculating and whether the entity is in the position to actually do that. A conceptual framework says that the entity is not in the position to calculate the value of itself. For both the goodwill accretion and the PH approach, we do recognize that impairment losses will arise earlier than the current model. But our concern is that it is difficult to understand what the balance sheet amount is, or in other words, what the measurement objective is. We do get to go through the calculation, get to a number, but this after impairment number, we don't really know what it is, or it's very difficult to explain what it is. And so that would be our concern. And regarding the discussion about the two shields in the IFRAC paper, we believe there's another shield, actually, which is the unrealized gains on other assets comprising the CGU. And to mitigate the effect of that unrealized gain, we think we need to go through step two that was under the previous US GAAP, but FASB decided to eliminate that. So I think we all know that it is very costly to do the whole calculation, and therefore we understand that simplification is necessary, but any of these ideas are very costly.
Okay, any other comments?
Raghava, I think you know my comment, quite consistent with the earlier one, but just on the simplification, we have some suggestions on, which might be, I think there were some questions in the infrared paper as well, in terms of, you know, whether a single model would work. So I think what our view is, where there is a market fair value, then of course I think the approach would be to use market fair value. And then where one is using a DCF approach, whether it's for fair value or for BRU, I think generally there should be a consistent DCF approach. So not necessarily calling it VIU, but more of a fair value with the future restructuring and you know, post tax, and also that you can eliminate those issues, but leave some room for you know, management intentions, because there might be situations where entities would not want to go for the highest and best use in the fair value approach. So of course, being able to back that up with how it's consistent with what they're doing, what they're saying in other parts of their annual report and management reports, and in terms of the quest, and perhaps because a lot of the things that we've heard from our constituents is about the allocation of goodwill and also in terms of other assets. So maybe if we make it simple in terms of allocating it at the operating segment level and make that clear, because end of the day, that's mostly the level at which the analysts look at the performance, so that makes sense to just go with that. And the last one is about how do you deal with deferred tax and deferred tax assets and liabilities. I guess if you're doing post-tax, then you know the carrying value can have the DTL or the DTA net. But of course, some might say that here the DTL or the DTA, so that you're comparing apples with apples, you know, whether you can allow them to discount those, so that, you know, you're comparing apples with apples.
So I have one question on the allocation of goodwill to CGUs. I mean, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, what IAS 36 says is the impairment testing is at a level at which management monitors goodwill.
Yeah.
And it can't be higher than an operating segment.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is it not something like, if management is monitoring at an operating segment level, why would there be concerns about going to a lower level or about allocation of goodwill? I mean, is it not, again, like a management approach of IFRS 8? Sorry, I might be making some sweeping statements here, but...
Yeah, but you're right. So most of the time that is the case, and I guess even for... You are looking at simplifying the test for goodwill, but just to make it clear, I was thinking that even for generally other assets, you know, so that it's, because it's quite arbitrary when you're in practice and you're seeing how they're allocating it, so to make it clear.
On the pH approach, so we get the underlying theory. I think the static nature of the adjustment, you said you were open-minded as to whether it would be a static or a dynamic approach, but I think the static nature is a limitation, so welcome some further thought on how it could be made less static. And on the single method, as Carla said, that is one of the ideas we explore in the FRAG paper, so I'll just reiterate, I think if you were to go for VIU, then I think it might need to be a somewhat modified VIU, because where we have, in an informal way, asked for feedback on whether in practice these numbers come out as greatly different, and the examples where there can be a big difference invariably do relate to future restructurings. Don't form part of the VIU, but might form part of the fair value calculation. Just on the idea of fair value or VIU, depending on expected manner of recovery, that gives me slightly... uncomfortable recollections of the practical application of the expected amount of recovery test in IAS 12, where you can get into a sort of blended recovery of some usage, then a sale, and that can quickly get quite complicated. So just a note of caution there.
Ross?
So just make sure I understand this. If you're putting the goodwill in multiple cash generating units, you have multiple headroom calculations at the date of the business combination.
Yep.
If you then restructure your business going forward, do you reallocate? Is that something you haven't got to? You would reallocate?
I think it's a problem with the static PH approach. We're still thinking about that, what happens when there's a restructuring, but I think there has to be some reallocation again.
And then when if you have a subsequent acquisition in the same cash generating unit, you would two headrooms.
What? Two headrooms.
Well, I was trying. Do you have two headrooms, or do you unwind the first headroom? No. Do you have two? So the original headroom stays with the original goodwill. If that works, or do you unwind and say it's a one, two?
Two.
We'll figure it out in the transition resort.
Thought is that when there's a new acquisition, the new headroom replaces the old headroom. So we're still working out examples and seeing how it works in different.
I have one headroom.
Yeah, I think so. We have examples in some of the past papers, so we're still looking at those.
So I think that's an important distinction, because that's different than others said. That's a easier. That might be, you know, not as easy, but that would make this easier.
I mean, that's the reason we're also looking at a continuously updated PH. But now the simplification of providing a relief from annual impairment testing. Now, the problem is if we need a continuously updated PH, so we can't really go down the route of giving a relief from the annual impairment testing. So there's a need to calculate recoverable amount every year to have an updated PH. So there's that bit of difficult interaction between the approaches we are looking at. So.
Some comment on the PH approach, because you just mentioned that the PH value will be updated every year, right?
No, that's a thought we are still exploring. Yeah.
Okay. Because some comments from the Chinese constituents that because according to the slides, they found that it seems that the PH value is fixed, so they have concerns about it, because for example the shrinkage of the original CGU or the new goodwill from the synergistic effect will also lead to the change of the pH value. So we think that we should update the pH value during the subsequent period for the impairment test of goodwill. Then the problem is, or the big challenge is, when and how to update the pH value. From the history of the development of goodwill measurement, we can see that one reason for the unrecognition of internal generated goodwill is that the measurement problem. We are very concerned about the measurement problem of the pH value under this approach. That's the comments on the pH approach. Another comments on the single method for determining the recoverable amount. In some cases, in most cases, we think these two should not produce significant different value. So, personally, it's hard to say which one is better. In practice, the IFRS provides these two value, the two methods. But in practice, we think it will not very costly for the enterprises to do the impairment test. Actually, maybe some entities, they just use VIU to
to do the impairment test. So the cost maybe is not a big problem in this regard. Another question is, if we decided to simplify the two methods, just to use one value, either fair value less cost or the VIU, the problem is, since we know that goodwill is allocated to the CGU for the purpose of impairment testing, then do you mean that the simplifying the method should only be limited to the goodwill impairment or to all the other long-term assets impairment test? That would be a big change to the IAS 36. Yeah, so we suggest to take this into account. And lastly, we do appreciate the efforts made by the ISB and also the effort to on improving the goodwill impairment to solve the too little and too late issues. We are still in the process of research, and at the same time, we also suggest that can we still spare some time or some resource on the research on the amortization of goodwill, although we know that the big problem for amortization of goodwill is the how to determine the amortization period and the amortization method. But we think it's worth a further research. Maybe we can do that at the same time. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Hans. Just a comment on using a single method to determine the recoverable amount. I mean, I think if one is to accept that you're not likely to get significantly different numbers, well, then one sort of says, okay, well, why not just have one? But I suppose that at the moment, they often do give rise to, or there can be significant differences. And I was just thinking, particularly in the mining space, where you could find that, again, if you were to value a company based on their share price, often, you know, that's much lower than a value in use calculation. And again, I suppose the debates are going to be, well, you know, has the market got it wrong? But I know that a couple of years ago, you know, we looked at some significant impairment testing, where if they were to use the book, use the market prices, there would have been huge impairments. So again, there was a motivation to then say, no, well, because it's the higher of the two, if you are able to justify your value in use being higher, well, then you can use that amount. So I suppose the question is you know, whether or not there were validly, you know, differences, or whether or not the value in use calculations were just overly optimistic. But yeah, I say in some cases it does look like there could be significant differences between the two.
Hansu?
We think the PH approach that takes existing goodwill into account makes sense. So, but one thing we are concerned about is that the future reduction of the PH might be fully subtracted from the purchased goodwill only. We would like to suggest that a possible improvement to the PH approach, which is allocating the impairment to the PH and as well as purchased goodwill, the existing purchased goodwill. So, I mean, we could allocate the impairment loss to both to the PH and to the existing the proxy generated goodwill. The model is too conservative. And,
yes, Alberto.
on this single method for the impairment testing. In slide 22, there are three possibilities. Fair value as cost of disposal only, value in use only, or fair value as cost of disposal or value in use, depending on how an entity expects to recover the asset. This is what we support, because we believe that there are cases where one or the other doesn't make sense. Let's take an extreme example. A company with just one plant, if they sell, the plant is sold, the company is out of business. And this is not what normally one expects. So in this case, value in use would be more appropriate. In other case, would be more appropriate fair value as cost of disposal, leaving the choice based on the business model or how the entity is better for us.
Just to react to what Alberto is saying, I think, in fact, the business models may vary for the same activity. And therefore, that's why it's difficult to choose between one of the two, because I have seen situations where people were using value in use for a period of time, and then the market was developing so fast that the fair value was justifying to arbitrate on this asset and invest elsewhere. So it's difficult to select one business model forever.
No,
I don't say maybe I misunderstood.
Based on how an entity expects to recover the asset, if over time they change what they think will do with this asset, they might change the impairment.
Understood.
Thank you.
Could I just ask for clarification on a couple of things? On Kim's example of the mining impairments you were talking about, what's the driver of the difference in those cases? Is it basically commodity prices and management having a different view of where the commodity price will be in the future from where it is today? Is that that's the main driver? Okay. So where you are in the cycle?
Yeah. And I guess there could also be other, you know, market sentiment and that type of thing, which is then built into the share price.
Yeah.
But it might not necessarily be reflective of what they're able to do. But again, you know, the future is only going to tell.
And I had a question for Sung Soo as well. So you were talking about allocating the impairment between the PH and the purchase goodwill. Is that just a pro rata allocation, or is it based in some way on whether you think it belongs more to the PH or to the purchase goodwill? Is it just a proportional allocation, or did you have something else in mind?
My idea?
Yeah.
My idea is that actually the existing generally internally generated goodwill maybe a proxy number, so that number will be taken into account when testing impairment. Then the number calculated by comparing the book value and the recovered amount, and then if the recovered amount, the book value exceeds the recovered amount, then we could calculate the impairment loss, possible impairment loss. The debt amount should be allocated to the PH side, and also the existing internal generated goodwill as a used proxy, a proxy.
Right.
So it could result in a less impairment loss actually recognized on the face of the financial statement, because the other part of the impairment loss would be allocated to the existing the proxy number. So. We think it's more
realistic and more convincing.
Yes, I understood that. I was trying to understand the basis for the allocation. Would it just be in proportion to the carrying amounts? Or would there be some other basis for the allocation? Yeah, I'll take it offline, maybe.
I thought, there was considerable skepticism about both the EFRAC model and the IFD model. I thought it was an interesting discussion, and I think the two models are actually complementary. They're based on the same premise, which is sort of to create a level playing field between regenerated goodwill and externally generated goodwill. But I must say that I tend to agree with Martin that if that is what you want, then probably amortization is the much cheaper and not much less judgmental than those two models. The question is, do we want to do it? But that would be a much simpler conclusion, solution. And then then the biggest problem becomes over what period?
10 years.
I would just pick a number and describe the same period for everybody.
Round number.
Huh?
10 years is a round number.
Yeah. Anyway, but I'm not at all sure if we want to go there. But if you want to go in that direction, I think that would be a much easier and also defensible, more easily defendable outcome than these rather complex models. Yeah, but it becomes less pressing. Yeah.
No, I'll save it. Sorry.
No? Okay, well, thank you very much.